And welcome to Manga Explaining, the show where we recommend great manga to folks who haven't read much manga before. Hosted by Deb Aoki, Christopher Woodrow Butcher, Chip Zdarsky, and myself, David Brothers. Follow along with our show notes and reading list at mangaexplaining.com and check out our newsletter and digital manga publisher at mangaexplainingextra.com. And this is a very special episode, so I practiced the intro before we got on so I didn't flub it this time.
Bravo.
So this is one of our rare sponsored episodes. This is sponsored by Kodansha. We are here to talk about Ashita no Joe Fighting for Tomorrow, a Japanese boxing manga series written by Asao Takamori, illustrated by Tetsuya Chiba. This is a sponsored episode of a book we definitely would have covered anyway, because I'm pretty sure I mentioned this on at least, I don't know, a fifth of the manga splitting episodes.
It's been in the show notes.
Fighting or boxing.
So many times, actually, that they're just like, you guys are going to do it, right? You guys are going to do it when we get emails.
Yeah. Like, there are some books we've willed into existence through manga splaining, and I think this might be, like, the peak for me, because we've got Hajime no Ippo and now Ashita no Joe. But I do want to run down the production team. This was translated by Asa Yoneda, lettered by Evan Hayden, edited by Daniel Joseph, with Risa Cho and Pei Ann Yip on production, and Kevin Wo proofreading. So, Ashita no Joe. It was serialized in Weekly Shonen Magazine from 68 to 73, so there's about 20 volumes of manga here. That's much, much shorter than, say, Naruto, which is, I think, 72 volumes of manga. Hmm. But this was a hit series back in the day. There was a major death in the series, and people in real life showed up to the character's funeral, kind of a feel. It was that kind of big. So it's really exciting to see it here in English. And it's one I've talked about a lot because I love boxing manga. And also I love kind of like stories about dirty cities and crime stories. And this is very much that. They kind of merge a working class, very like kind of super poor, honestly, culture with boxing. And they kind of show you a way that one kid punches his way out of it just for kind of orientation. So there's an anime, there's two movies, there's a second anime, and then there's also live action movies and spin-off anime. So over the past 50 years, Ashita no Joe's had a very long reach. But this core series has always been out of our reach here in America. We've had the anime, but never the manga. And I am really excited to talk about it here today because it came out in an interesting time in Japan. It was one of those books where like college students were into it. There was like a lot of social commentary threaded throughout the work that was very relevant at the time. And all I can think is that it's similar to Marvel Comics of the same era, like late 60s, early 70s, where Stan Lee and other people were doing stories where it's like, oh, this is ripped from the headlines in a way we can understand. But also it's like really exciting and the drawings are really good. Like, Gene Colan was on Daredevil when this came out, for instance, and X-Men still wasn't good yet, but it was kind of getting there. So, you can probably guess how I feel about this, so I'll save my take for last. Christopher, how do you feel about Ashita no Joe?
Full disclosure, I do work for Kodansha, so this is
so we're sponsored and you work for Kodansha.
Yeah, highly compromised episode. I actually work for Kodansha Japan and USA now. It's getting weird.
Amazing.
Yeah, I don't know where to start with this book. This is a book you have to read. Like, I don't, if you're talking about manga, I am so glad I got to finally read it because it is so woven into the fabric of popular culture in Japan. It's like this lovable loser we're all overcoming, like this whole deal, right?
Mm-hmm.
I was a little worried that the reality of the book wouldn't live up to the mythology of the book because it is so widely discussed. Like, there's a statue of Joe from Ashita no Joe towards the end of his career that is like him sitting, finally taking a break on like a bench. Or, well, he's in the ring in the actual step. But this statue, they made them. They made like thousands of them, and they're dotted all over Japan. And people buy them to put in front of their bars so that you can know, oh, this is the place where a real working man can get a drink. Or it's an Ashita no Joe theme bar, and I think we've encountered two or three, maybe Deb will talk a little bit about that.
Maybe it's a place where you go in and you're just going to get the crap kicked out of
just
you.
Just absolutely destroyed.
All I can think of is the Ronald McDonald statues we have in the U.S.
Yeah,
Japan
yeah.
got such a better deal.
So Deb, you're muted.
That's fine. I mean, I'm just laughing.
Well, I know, but we need
we love laugh. The sound of we your laughter.
Your melodious laughter. Otherwise, it's just bros.
Bros. It's wow. Just me.
Yeah, just David.
What a mask book this is. Like, there's one woman, and she's introduced halfway through, and everyone just keeps calling her a cold-hearted bitch. Or a, like, beautiful, like, Madonna-type figure. Like, there is so much going on in this book. Like, it almost doesn't matter what I think of it, but I like it. I think it has to be read if you're kind of serious about manga. And I'm really glad it's in English. Like that's my first thought on this. Yeah.
And Deb, as our resident manga historian / everything in manga, what did you think about Ashita no Joy? Like, you've got such a broad body of knowledge with manga. Like, I feel like this must have ticked quite a few boxes for you.
Oh, this was so amazing to finally read it. Mm-hmm. You know, because the ending scene of Ashita no Joy is so iconic that it has become this symbol of like being tired and just done. I have a collection of screenshots of Korean webtoons where the character is faced with a ridiculous situation, like, I'm done, I've had it. And then they're in that pose. And it's really funny. It's such an iconic series, and it's such, to the point where it's parodied. It's really weird to finally read the real thing and to read the very first chapters of it, which sets up the premise of the story, where, you know, Joe is basically, you know, pretty much an orphan. I mean, he's a 20, I'm assuming he's like a 18 or 20 something year old kid.
15.
Who comes apart.
15.
He's 15. Yeah.
I know. That was like the funniest part to me reading
this. Whoa. Because he's like coming, he's like walking into this slum, and he's like got like not a care in the world. He's full of swagger and attitude, right? But in a really, in a really kind of way that you can't hate him. He's kind of, you know, like kind of just happy-go-lucky, not like hot. You know, like he's kind of like the equivalent of a guy coming in with his skateboard and, you know, doing a couple of tricks, going, "Hey, I'm here," versus, you know, someone coming in with like his, you know, Ford F-50 truck going, "I'm here," you know. That's a different vibe, but I think what's interesting to realize is that when it came out, and the world that is depicted in this manga is so different than the Japan we know today, right?
Mm, yeah,
absolutely.
It's post-war. It's during that period of recovery. Japan is not like that, you know, futuristic utopia where you sit on any toilet and it's heated and it squirts your undies.
And it sings to you for comfort.
Wait, squirt your undies is the phrase of the year.
Yeah, we're editing that out, right?
Well, not now that it's funny.
When you come to Japan nowadays, it's like it's this marvel of modern conveniences, and, you know, just people are living pretty nice lives. Even the sketchiest parts of Tokyo are not that sketchy. Compared to some places in the world, you know, so it's interesting to read this series at that time, because it depicts a time when Japan was, you know, kind of scrappy, right? People were poor and people weren't guaranteed a living, and there were orphans and people living in really decrepit situations. Like, there's scenes where I forget the coach, like, I think falls into a ditch. And there used to be more of these types of things in Japan where that's the sewer.
It's an open sewer, yeah.
It's an open sewer. So when I first went to Japan, when I was 8 years old, I'm dating myself, but this was 1973. So I got a glimpse of Japan at that era. And it was very different. It was also 350 yen to the dollar. But it was a different time, right? I mean, so that's, and as a tourist, I didn't get to see this kind of world of Japan where, you know, there are orphans and drunkards and people like living these hand-to-mouth lives. But I think one of the weird things about Ashita no Joy, and people I think forget about it, is the art is by Tetsuya Chiba, who is a legendary manga creator. He's still alive today, and, you know, because he's a teacher and a scholar and just considered one of those legends of manga. But it was written by Iki Kajiwara, who wrote many manly manga. So, like, I think people sometimes like think, oh, it's a Tetsuya Chiba book. It's like, no, it's actually a product of two people. And the fact that it's a sports manga, but it's so much more. So
yeah,
it's one of those weird things where it's like, you know, like we did Manga Manga a couple of weeks ago, right? And Manga Manga, when it first came out in 1983, you know, it was just full of manga that, you know, Fred Schott thought was, you know, and many other people thought were just defining moments of manga. And almost none of it was available in English. Ashita no Joy was one of those stories that has just, you know, stood out there as like, wow, if this, everyone thinks this one is really important. Oh, wow, everyone thinks this one, this story is so amazing and meaningful. And then all you could do was like, it was like being outside of a store window and like making fog on the window and going like, I think there's something in there and I think it's interesting, but I can only wonder.
And literally now, me. Yeah.
You get this glimpse of this manga 40 years ago in Manga, which itself was 20 years earlier. And you're like, oh, that looks really interesting. I wonder how long I'll have to 2024. 2024 is how long you will have to wait from 1983 to actually read this manga. It's wild.
That's wild.
So, yeah, I didn't know what to expect. And honestly, you know, I'm glad this is a double volume because, like, you know, you mentioned, it's 20-something series, and everyone knows it's got two strikes against it. It's old and it's long, right?
Yeah.
I'm glad it's two volumes to begin with because, frankly, it takes a little while for it to get to the boxing.
Fair.
Just saying.
Yeah.
But I will get into this. I want to hear what Chip has to think.
Yeah, Chip. I love that you made a face when Deb said Joe was lovable. So yeah, I
mean, it's funny when you actually made the comparison to early Marvel, I was like, oh yeah, yeah, because Peter Parker is unlikable.
Yeah.
Like he's kind of angry all the time and like kind of pushes his friends away and stuff, but he still does like a good thing by being Spider-Man. And like I definitely kind of bounced off Joe a fair amount.
Wow.
He got quite repetitive. Being an absolute jerk to literally everyone, while also smirking. I mean, but part of it is the fact that I can tell that the artist is obviously excellent, but I think it's just a product of the time period that the character's face doesn't change a lot. Mm-hmm. It's kind of the same three-quarter smirk, like constantly, no matter what the situation. So there's not a lot of kind of depth of emoting in the faces of the main character, but the secondary characters there are. Like the hero and the lone female, they kind of stay very static, but everyone else is kind of like the Greek chorus of the kids. They emote a lot more.
Yeah, absolutely.
And I think that's just a thing to do with the time.
I think about it like he's the lead actor. Like he's the pretty boy lead actor that they hire who, even when he's going through it, has to remain pretty, which is a movie trope all over the world, but especially in Japanese film. Like if you hire... like, you know, some sort of musician to come in and be the lead in your movie. He is beautiful in every frame of that movie because his talent agency wrote it into the contract that he's beautiful and doesn't emote and doesn't make an ugly face. Yeah. And that's how I read that, but you're absolutely right, Chip.
Yeah, it makes it hard to kind of connect emotionally a little bit. I will say this is the slowest paced, fastest paced book I've ever read.
Oh my God, yeah.
It manages to do both at the same time. Huh. Like within two pages, that coach character appears. He's like, this guy's got it. I got to train him. And he hits that point so many times over this massive volume.
Yeah.
Where he goes, this guy's the real deal. I'm like, yeah, we knew that on page two when you said it. Like he just keeps saying it. And it's like, it does take a long time to actually get to the point where he accepts the help and trains to box. And even then, it's reluctantly accepting the help. But so much happens in between, like all the stuff of him and his gang of urchins ripping people off, which is definitely the funniest part of this.
Yeah, they're not even orphans, by the way. Like they have
pretending to be orphans. They're pretending to be orphans. But like I actually laughed out loud at the on page 123. Looking out for our most vulnerable children. A photo in the paper of Joe with all the kids honoring his late mother's legacy. Joe's message. Yeah, that was very funny. And like that, and like eventually going off to that prison for juvenile delinquents. Like I didn't expect it. And that's, you know, that's rare to read this kind of book that's, you know, I mean, now it's all tropes, right?
Yeah.
You know, the guy with the natural talent and the coach and like, you know, working his way up to his first big fight.
The coach being someone who had former glory and is now a drunk.
Yeah, exactly. There's so much there. And this may be the first one to do it. I don't know. But to not give you that for so long, like the actual boxing, but still keep it interesting. Like all the different characters he encounters and again, going to that prison. And also doing that thing where I feel like it's almost like a video game trope. Oh. Where like when he goes to like the first prison, the nice prison or whatever you want to call it, and there's like the one big bad guy there.
Yeah.
And then that bad guy becomes like the scared, like, I'm so weak compared to what's coming next. You have no idea. Like, that's a video game feeling. Like, you beat that first guy and it was so hard. And by the time you're on to like the 10th guy that you're beating, you're just like, oh, I remember how easy that first guy was. Like, he was nothing compared to this. But yeah, I really like the buildup of it all. It's funny. And this is the wrong way to view this book. But as I kept reading it, I kept thinking, like, if this is Spider-Man, what's the ultimate Spider-Man version of this to make it for the modern audience?
Hachimeno
Ippo. That's the thing. You can tend to bounce off of it in places because of the age of the material and how they're pacing it.
Yeah. Yeah.
But I kept thinking, like, oh, like, and it's not the way you should view any kind of work of art. It's like, if someone remade this now, like, what would it look like? And I just kept having that thought. I don't know.
I would say the boxer.
Like remake mode.
The boxer, which is like the Korean one that we read, right?
Yeah, the boxer is great.
Oh, yeah. So Ashton O'Jo, for its 50th anniversary, they created Megalobox, which is like all caps title.
Right.
Yeah. Which is an anime. It's only anime. There's like a small manga, but it's primarily anime, which is basically boxing, but you have robot arms that help you box. Mm-hmm. And the Joe character he doesn't use the arms. He's just that good. Like, that's his thing.
Oh, that's pretty good.
He's gearless Joe.
There's a really amazing thing in Megalobox, and I think I've mentioned it before, but if you watch it, there's a cameo of Tetsuya Chiba and Ikki Kajiwara in a bar.
Huh. Nice.
Like the original creators of Ashton O'Jo, they're in a bar, and this is when the character in Megalobox is celebrating his win. And so you see Tetsuya Chiba, who is drawn... When he was drawing this, he was a teenager practically, right? Maybe in his early 20s. But they draw him in the anime, this, you know, a little cameo scene where he's an old man as he is today. And then Ikki Kajiwara looks like a, you know, kind of like a guy in his 30s or 40s with like a buzz cut. And then they're just like toasting each other like, yeah, we did it, man.
That's pretty cool.
That's nice.
Yeah, and the nice thing about Megalobox is that they pull characters and concepts from this. Like Sachi, the only other woman in the book, the small girl, she becomes Sachio, the boy sidekick character in Megalobox who looks up to Joe and kind of plays a similar role. But yeah, so that's like totally ultimate Megalobox. It's that's a good train of thought, I think.
Huh. Interesting.
Yeah, so I guess it's my turn.
Yeah, go for it.
David hates it.
No, this was obviously very up my alley. I made a note in here. I was going to say, Deb, this is the most David genre manga ever.
Yeah.
Because like 400 pages of it are just hijinks in a city amongst like criminal youths, you know?
The most David manga ever. That's the pull quote, right?
Yeah. Put that on the cover. But like it opens with, here's beautiful Tokyo, you know, a jewel of a city, blah, 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 blah. But we're going over here where all of the poor people live. And they, you know, kind of turn away from the Tokyo we were talking about before, like Deb mentioned. And I love this kind of like, it feels like it went back in time 30 years from the Tokyo on the first couple pages. And all the characters, the drama, everyone's straight out of central casting. Like all of the housewives have like that apron and like the flower print, you know?
When the kids showed up, I was like, oh, this is like David's central casting comment about the ruffians in that manga that we read. Oh, it was another old manga. It was Devilman. Another classic. Yeah. Sorry, classic.
All we need is like the delinquent with the straw in his mouth and like the leaf.
With the scar,
but actually, that's Rikishi, who we meet halfway through the book. He becomes that guy.
Yeah, that color page at the beginning has him with the stalk of wheat or whatever in his mouth. It's perfect.
So like very foundational.
The kids are the self-insert and the comic relief, right?
Yeah. When they showed up dressed up to go to prison and it was all just nonsense. It felt like Frank Miller costume design from Sin City, where there's just stuff dangling all over the place. But no, I like this a lot. And the most surprising thing about reading it in English versus watching the animation or, you know, reading what other people say about it online is that it feels like it comes from a time before we had story arcs in the comic sense.
Yeah. Things just happen.
You know, like nowadays. Yeah, this would be like the Toko Reformatory arc, the, you know, small town violence arc. This is just, you're following his stories, you know, for the next 600 pages and what happens.
Yeah, there's no hard cut.
Which I think is why it repeats, you know, like Chip was saying. Like he's always reinforcing because if someone dropped in, you know, in month six, they're not going to know what's up.
Well, we were talking about that with Webtoons. Like, I did an interview with one of the guys from Kakao and he was saying that with Webtoons, it has to be really simple to understand week to week.
Mm-hmm.
You have to be able to drop in every week and be able to just get into what's happening without a lot of complicated backstory.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
You have to just get into it and then not have to refer back to issue blah, 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 blah to understand why this, you know, this guy hates this guy or why this thing is happening. So, you know, if you think about it, this is weekly serialization. There's a little bit of a repeat at each chapter to say, well, the last time we were here, like this was happening, this was happening. And now on with our story, you know, kind of like old time movie serials.
Yeah. Or Jim Shooter Marvel comics.
Yeah, exactly. It's, it's of that time, right? Where they didn't assume you read it everything or you were reading faithfully.
Not necessarily. Because, I mean, it's obviously, you're probably, if you're a kid reading this in the 60s, doing a little better than the kids who are depicted in this book, but probably not much. You know, like you're not living in a slum. Probably you're probably living in a suburb, but your parents aren't making crazy money or anything like that. So yeah, you may not get your hands on every single issue of the magazine that it's in. You know what I mean? So if you miss 2 weeks or 3 weeks because you don't have any pocket money, or your parents are having a bad week, or your dad's an alcoholic or whatever, like, yeah, it's all in there. It's all in this book. Then yeah, you have to be able to like jump in again. And I think that that's wild, because shonen manga does not assume that anymore. Shonen manga is now written for collection in the tankobon, right?
Yeah.
And it gets back to Ultimate Spider-Man. This was John Byrne's hugest, noted crank John Byrne's hugest criticism of Bendis's Ultimate Spider-Man was that it was written for the trade and no one should buy those issues, and it's a complete disgrace, and it took him 6 issues to do what Stanley and Steve Ditko did in like 1.5. Oh. And it's like, it's a different audience now. It's a different, like a different time. So I think that that's real. You're going to read this and you're going to be like, this is like, the pacing is so different than contemporary comics.
Yeah.
And I don't know if it's for the better, but it's definitely really interesting.
I like how dense it feels. Like, Dan mentioning the Boxer was really good, because I feel like this book, the Boxer gets the first, like, I don't know, 400 pages of this out of the way in like 10 pages in chapter one.
Yeah.
And this is also, I was thinking this is from before we really had explainer manga in the sense that we do now, because they don't explain the rules of boxing until like 20 pages before the end.
Yeah.
And how they do it is like the coach sends Joe postcards explaining boxing techniques. But here's the thing. It doesn't show diagrams. It just does it with words. And so you're just supposed to assume to, I know, but like when you read other, like, oh, remember All-Rounder Meguru?
Yeah.
The MMA one manga that we did, where it literally shows you a diagram of like this, your weight's on this foot and your shoulder's going back and then it's going to pow like this. Mm. Whereas with this one, you know, like nowadays, one thing that's about mangas, like there's generally 7 is about the max amount of panels you're going to get on a page, right? And even that's considered dense. This one has a lot of panels per page.
There's a couple that were great. And it's all over.
I'm on a 10 panel page right now.
Oh, shit.
Page 229. Yeah. No dialogue. It's all walking, too.
See, that's kind of an interesting thing about this thing, too, because this isn't created at a time before all the truisms that manga artists use now. Tell a story this way. Use this many panels. Introduce a character this way. All those rules were not there. Mm-hmm. And so it's surprising to read in that regard.
Yeah. Christopher, I've got a question for you. I know you're a Tezuka guy. And when they introduced the lady in this, I was like, oh, this guy must have been really influenced by Tezuka. Like, I can see it in his art, kind of. Or is that just kind of the style of the day? Like, what's your take on that angle?
I feel like there's a couple of tropes in this from manga that I was like, the Greek Chorus of the Kids kind of works, but the little girl reminded me a lot of Pinnacle from Blackjack.
Oh, from Blackjack.
Yeah, and she's my least favorite character in a Tezuka manga, period. Like, I actually sold all my Blackjacks off because I could, every time I picked it up to read them, I was like, nah. I made a killing, too. I had all the other print rare ones. And then I moved to Taiwan.
David, do either of you like
that? No, that's crazy.
It's fine. I think Pinoko is, her story is very funny because it's horrible to her parents.
It's like, there's some, the episode that introduces her is really good. And then after that, she's like sort of a sexy adult woman trapped in an artificial girl's body who's constantly trying to have, like a little girl, like who's like 6, who's constantly trying to make Blackjack her husband. And it's just like, And she talks in a baby voice, like an uwu voice, the whole time. And it's like the worst part of any Tezuka comic ever. Like, I hate it so much. Like, ooh, you're so sexy. I want to make you my husband. And it's like a 6-year-old girl who's also like maybe totally artificial. We don't quite get into that. Like, it's Blackjack's a medical manga.
It's a lot.
Like, maybe we have to read it now. Anyway,
I was going to say, the next time I have to suggest something, I'm suggesting that.
Yeah.
Thanks. Blackjack Volume 1. just Blackjack. Whatever one has Pinocchio in it.
Yeah.
David, I am sorry. I've lost the thread. Pinocchio has broken my
mind. Tezuka's influence on manga in this era, and is Ashinojo an answer or a response to it?
I think it's an evolution for sure. I think you could definitely see the Tezuka influences, but it's Star System, the Tezuka Star System, where he would have like the same character design play different roles across different series. I think that's where you get to, like, you know, Joe is the leading man, so he's beautiful. What's her name's the leading lady, so she's beautiful but cold. And then she'll eventually warm up, I assume, by the end of the series. So everyone else can be like a gross villain, right? Like, you can do all that other stuff with them, like Chip was saying, and have these like exaggerations and caricatures and things like that. Tezuka does that too.
Oh, you know who does that up too? Mitsuru Adachi, Cross Game.
Yeah, Adachi's the same way.
Yeah.
Actually, there's a huge amount of Adachi here. Yeah. Remember when we read Cross Game? That was the one thing that, like, with the art, there's some amazing silent panels in this. Some amazing, like, streetscapes and quiet scenes, and where he'll take 2 or 3 panels to really establish a scene. But, like, Adachi, which was Cross Game, is, like, 30 years later, I think, or 40 years, probably 40 years later, does it more. He'll do whole pages of just like panels of like beautiful baseball fields and like the school and whatever. So yeah, I think that's another way that things have evolved from Ashinojo into Adachi, and then Rumiko Takahashi is the evolution from there. Like, yeah, this is a foundational work in a lot of ways, but it's not the foundational work, because most of contemporary manga springs out of Tezuka in the like 50s, and not all of it. We've been gently chastised in the comments for that. There are other streams of manga and other creators that were contemporaries of Tezuka that did their own thing.
Tezuka was such a mentor and such a guiding light to so many creators,
including these dudes, right?
I mean, Tetsuya Chiba lived in Tokiwaso for a while, famously.
Tokiwaso, for those who don't know, is the famous boarding house where all the manga creators lived in Tokyo after they like moved from the sticks or from Osaka to like come and work in Tokyo. So it's like a big rooming house where Chip, trying to imagine a rooming house where every single creator in Toronto worked at some point at the same time. Sort of like your original Raid studio, but like 3 times as big and like way worse, like way
poorer. And also you live there.
And also you live there, and also there's no bathtub. So sometimes you bath in the sink. Like, there's a lot going on.
The kitchen sink.
All dudes. Till the very end, there's a lady. Anyway. Yeah. David, great question. And I think, yeah, foundational, but not the foundation. And it definitely built, and you can see it in the work. But Tezuka also was operating for like 30 or 40 years too. So he evolved over the course of his career.
Yeah.
I mean, by the time he got to 1973, Tezuka is already a legend, right?
Yeah.
Tetsuya Chiba never lived with Tezuka in that... Tezuka lived there in the beginning, and then he kind of did what most artists do who that have a rent-controlled apartment. They tell their friends, hey, I'm moving out, dude. Why did you move in? You know? Like, Tetsuya Chiba, like, that style that he draws, right? He's drawn so many different sports comics, like golf and judo and stuff like that, just by himself. But what sets Ashinojo apart is the Ikikajiwara writing, which is very much... You know, even though I think some of there's a childish, boyish vibe to it, but I think they're part of what people talk about, why this series really hit in a way, like, I'm going to stretch here, the way Chainsaw Man hits now. It's because it's like about income inequality.
Yeah.
And it's told in a way that's engaging, and it doesn't like say, you know, it's about income inequality. It's wrapped up in an adventure, but it becomes something where, this is so unfair. Life is so unfair. But this guy, he's fighting, you know, like he's trying to make it out of it.
That's an interesting comparison, Deb. I don't know.
And in Chainsaw Man, it's so unfair, but he wants to get laid so bad.
Yeah, I can see it. Also, another factor is the 68, 69 university protests in Japan.
Oh, yes.
Like, it's coming out of a period of people being like, this isn't good, right? Like, we can change this, right? Mm-hmm. Chip, as a fellow Action Comics aficionado, what did you think of all the fighting in this book?
It was well done. Again, it kind of took me a while to get used to the format of it. Because when, you know, big action scenes happen, you tend to have, like, you know, the one big panel, the two big panels. But a lot of the fight scenes were pretty dense. Mm-hmm. But yeah, the gesture of it all was amazing. I didn't really follow it in terms of, like, boxing moves, no matter how many times they told me, oh, yeah, left cross, right, upper jab, blah, blah, blah. I'm just like, oh, this is cool looking punches.
Yeah.
And eventually one of them is going to connect. So yeah, so I liked it, but it wasn't the driving force of the book for me. It was kind of it was pretty secondary. I thought it was really, really funny just the way they depicted the power of Joe. It's almost like writing yourself into a corner a little bit, because like there's so many scenes where he just beat the living hell out of like 40 grown-ups, yeah, like all cops, like no problem. And then all
there's
of a sudden,
a lot of cops getting wrecked in this book.
I know.
That's also wish fulfillment for the reader.
I know. If you're on Team ACAB, this is the book for you.
Yeah. Yeah.
But the funny thing is, then they'll have a scene where Joe gets like physically dragged into the courtroom by two cops, and I'm like, like I just saw him beat the hell out of 40 of them. Like what? Like
now he's all tuckered out.
It's a little bit of a Marvel Comics like power level thing where you power a character up too much and then it's like, well, they can do anything at that point.
Yeah.
So I found that really funny, especially at one point one of them mentions like Muhammad Ali. I'm just like, I don't think Muhammad Ali could beat up 40 cops at the age of 15.
No. Like, maybe 30, but come on.
Yeah, it may be 30, but it's just funny, especially when they pull in the real world comparisons. I'm like this is not real world. So it's very funny to have the greatest boxer of all time be mentioned. And you're just like, yeah, I think Joe could probably beat him up.
Yeah.
It's kind of like also like One Punch Man, you know?
Yeah.
One of the things that I've heard people mention, like older shonen manga of this era was done at a time when, you know, like they were trying to encourage young people to work hard and help Japan get out of its economic, you know, basically lower middle class status in the world. Mm. Right. And, you know, and to the, we have to work hard and we have to keep striving and, you know, go to work and make, do your best because Japan's counting on you. Right. And you got to do the best because, you know, and, you know, you're going to rise up and have the middle class life you always dreamed of, those kind of things. And then I remember people telling me about after the recession in Japan in the early 2000s, 2010s or something like that, that a lot of young people in Japan were feeling like, you know, that's quite a bill of goods you sold me because I worked so hard and then I graduated and I can't get a job. Which led us to the kind of isekai manga where it's like the main character is a hardcore gamer, does nothing with his life, and then gets transported to the game world, and they are immediately the most powerful guy in the thing. He doesn't have to go through a training arc; he just is just the most powerful guy in that fantasy
did the
world.
Training,
like, yeah, playing video games, right?
Finally, yeah. My skills are useful.
Yeah, yeah, just powerful, and all the girls want him, and you know that's it. And then that's when the story starts. So you compare that with Ashino Joe, where it's like, it's weird, right? Because Joe starts out pretty powerful, right? He starts out as that protagonist who is strong and gifted, but still has ways to go.
Yeah.
He doesn't start from absolute zero, let's put it that way.
Yeah, it's hard to show that kind of that evolution when the character starts off just so powerful.
Hmm.
I think they figured it out while they were doing it.
Yeah, that's the thing. You buy into it because you can tell that like the whole story hasn't been planned out, obviously.
It feels week to week. Yeah. There's so much of what we read that was like, oh, we figured it out. We know how we can like he has the raw power, but he hasn't been trained. And so this guy who's been trained, who was like a welterweight fighter, who is 8 feet tall and also somehow a teenager in juvenile hall.
Yeah.
He's the guy that's going to beat the shit out of Joe because he's been trained. And so Joe has to now train. And that's how we can get him up to that next power level. And it's, yeah, there definitely is a crazy energy in this that they're just kind of making it up. It gets better as it goes, too, I think.
I could totally see that.
Yeah.
Also, I like the fact that that guy trained by beating up multiple bulls.
Oh my God, he's punching, charging. I laughed out loud. I was on the plane reading it. Andrew looked over at me and I'm like, I don't know how to explain this, but one of the characters is training by punching, charging bulls directly in the head and knocking them unconscious. And Andrew's like, oh, that sounds really good.
What I love about that scene is that since you never see him do it, it could have just been a trick to psych out Joe.
Yeah.
I was kind of waiting for that.
Yeah, this is a very funny manga. We haven't really mentioned, I think, where Chip was talking about the kind of repetition, thanks to serialization. I think that's definitely true because of the power creep as well. Because like Nishi, his friend he meets, who he beats up and then, you know, becomes his best friend. He goes from a boss to a kitten to like, hey, by the way, I was just pretending to be scared that whole time. I'm actually on your side. And it feels like the writer being like, oh, crap, I can't do anything else with this guy. I need him to play this role now, you know?
Yeah, because like sometimes it's like Bakugo in like My Hero Academia, right? Like, it's like, wait, he's supposed to be a dick, but everyone loves him.
So, yeah. <you know?
laughs> It's really fun because reading Ashita no Joe is a little bit like hearing the blues for the first time after many years of listening to the Beastie Boys.
Oh, wow. That's pretty good.
Like, it's strange. To see the original. I think
the translation helps with that feeling, I think, because it feels good. Like, there were a couple of times when I noticed words that while I was reading, but it's more like, oh, like, that's like the right choice for that instead of it taking me out of the story. Mm. Like, at some point, someone says, like, old broads, and I'm like, yeah, this is like a broads story. This is it.
Oh, I like that part, but when one of the characters calls another character like a chode, and I was like,
that was weird.
And like, I don't want to really get into like, oh, that word choice or whatever, but I was having a lot of disassociative stuff with this manga anyway, because the whole manga starts off like you're in like the 1920s, like the global recession, like the American slums, the whole deal, but you're in 1960s Japan, which is not something, again, like Deb was saying, that you really associate with Japan, like that level of poverty. But I'd done my reading and I kind of got it. But then they're using like words through, well, I mean, it's translated, but they're using words that are like kind of all over the place in terms of when they might be used. Like it's not period. If you get what I'm saying, like when it started, I felt like it was going to be heavily a period piece. And by the end of it, I'm like, no, like they literally are in a fantasy children's jail. Like that's some like Harry Potter level shit where like a theater troupe of nerds comes in and performs like Quasimodo. Like there's so much going on in this that is fantastic that by the end of the book I was fully on board, but there was some disassociative stuff in the first couple.
It wasn't exactly Johnny Cash at Folsom Prison, let's put it that way. Yeah,
right. They didn't whip that guy for real. That's pretty intense.
That was so crazy.
Yoko, the lady we've been talking about is Yoko. She's a rich heiress. I don't know if her parents are dead, but she's rich. And apparently it lets her bring a theater troupe to the prison. And one of the bits they do is they get Coach Danpei Tange, this, you know, kind of old rummy, to dress as Quasimodo. And then she whips him viciously. And the crowd is like, geez, this is really intense. And then they're like, okay, we just needed him for the beating. Here's the real Quasimodo actor.
Like, we just need to beat this dude. Like, that's the cultural stuff that I'm like, did people just like watching old alcoholics get their shit, you know, wrecked in the prison, 60s?
Like the prison, yes, they're playing to the crowd.
But the audience of us, like the reader at the time, is that a trope that I am not aware of? Like, we've just got to beat
I would say the reader at the time was like 10 years old.
Yeah, it's like, well, I hate Alcoholics in the Park. They're creepy, so I'm glad that guy got whipped. Like, that's weird.
I read that scene as a ruse.
Oh?
Because they talk, we don't see them have the conversation, but they mentioned that those characters talk, the coach and the heiress, beforehand. So it's like the coach is like, let me go on stage for a bit to prove that I'm supposed to be here, and then I can go off stage and like find Joe or
whatever.
Like that felt like a switch to me.
Oh. Yeah.
Like that was my reading on it anyways.
That's I can really see that, yeah.
Yeah. I didn't get that at all.
I was going to say with the language stuff, it was funny reading this as like it feels like a kid's story, and then every once in a while you have a phrase like one of my favorite phrases was "Let's see what your balls are made of."
Yeah. There's a lot of manly talk for a couple chapters there. Yeah, it was good.
It is a very manly manga. Come on.
This is true. But it's a manly manga, but also has, like, my favorite line in this was the coach saying, "Sad to say, I'm head over heels for those two arms of yours."
Yes.
what a funny phrase that was.
It's like romantic but not homoerotic in a weird way. Far from sex, but yeah. Still like adoration.
It's romantic, but yeah, over a teenager's arms.
Yes, they're beautiful. I think we can all agree that they're beautiful in a non-sexual.
Yeah.
The first like five pages has him going, "Yeah, I try to stay away from like has Joe saying to the coach, "I try to stay away from creepy old men in the park who promise that we're going to get a mansion together and like be rich and famous together." Like, no thanks, creeper. And that's like the only thing in 580 pages that's like anyone is interested. Like, there might be sexual anything at all going on. Is that page?
Yeah.
And then for the rest of it, he's in multiple all male prison situations, and it's just like, "No, we just actually want to like physically assault you. There won't be any sex." And it's like, shoujo manga and BL of the time would beg to differ, sir, about what happens if you put a bunch of boys in a room.
That was also a time when like shonen manga was definitely just for boys, right?
Oh, and yeah.
Ask boys. Boys that like to fight.
Yeah.
Man, oh man.
If I ever find an Ashiten or Joe doujinshi where the coach and Joe get it on, I will show it off to you. But honestly, I cannot imagine it. But I don't think it exists because, you know, there wasn't that kind of evolution of skeeviness.
Yeah.
I think people took this series at face value. Let's put it that way.
We're running short on time, but I've got a little brother's moment and then final thoughts. Sounds good? Okay, so actually I have a lot of little brother's moments, but I narrowed it down to two.
Okay.
Page 285, there's an outline of a light bulb before Joe gets beaten up.
Oh, okay. I'm there. Yeah.
So on the lower side of this page, just like that single line defining the light bulb.
Oh, yeah. Where the lights go.
That's really just super artful. And later in the story, like they show that panel again and the light turns on. And I'm like, this is just such good comics making.
Yeah.
And then on page 519, this is just a funny one, is when they're fighting in the ring. And they're like, oh, who's going to be the referee? And the kid dressed as a referee stands up and is like, "Hey, I'm in the club at school. I could be the referee." So, like, he came to a boxing match dressed as a referee just in case he would have a chance. I don't know, man.
I like also, he's just like, "Do you think I could serve as referee?" Like,
yeah, he's not even like not aggressive even about it.
I had a little brother's moment.
Yeah, let's hear it.
One. On page 448. There's all the cops and blah, blah, blah. And it's like after a fight or whatever. And just the weirdest joke that I didn't quite understand. In the bottom corner, it's just a guy, one of the cops peeing.
Huh?
And the one guy goes, "Idiot, what are you, a puppy?"
Like, you can't control your bladder, yeah.
And he's like, I need another sec. Like, it's just such a weird detail on a page where it relates to nothing. And I was just like, what? Was that a weird thing that was cut or?
You want to know a weirder part on top of that? On page 449, right after that, there's a puddle of pee next to the car.
Oh,
so it clearly,
yeah, it's something. You drew it twice. It has to be something. Yeah.
I think it belies that it's for kids every once in a while. I think that's what's going on there.
Yeah,
like peeing is funny. Talking about your balls is hilarious. The farting, all the kids getting up for that talent show and each doing their like fart-related dummy stuff. Like it was. I'll save it for final thoughts. Is there final thoughts? Is that where we're at?
Yeah, final thoughts. Chris, what do you got?
This book feels re-edited by the original creators after it was serialized. It's like Akira. There's no chapter pages. There's no breaks. And as we learned with Akira from reading it, huge amounts of that were like redrawn and repurposed. So like, I think if you're telling a shonen story in like the 60s, you probably can't get away with a like 6 or 8 page images and text introduction that like with narration, right? Like that didn't happen in, you know, Weekly Shonen magazine. And so I'm fascinated by the graphic novelization or the tonkabanization, I guess, of this story for us as readers, as like, this is a classic. So we're going to get to finally tell it the way that we've always intended. And then taking that and importing it without book breaks, because this is actually, I think Deb was saying 3 volumes, actually.
Three, wow.
Like maybe 2 2/3, but I'll double check and we'll put it in the show notes. Yeah, there's like there's something going on with this that makes it flow more smoothly, sort of like when we read Devilman and sort of when we've read some other things, that we're not getting the same experience you would have. And that felt like a holdover. And I think that there's a lot of little weird holdovers in this. Like, we're going to have the kids come and do a talent show for a chapter. It interrupts the narrative so badly, but it was kind of great.
Yeah.
But my final thought is, there are some pages with some of the best sound effects I've ever seen in a manga. Cool. And I'm not talking about, like, the English sound effects were well integrated, but they left the Japanese sound effect in. Cool. And some of those pages are awesome. Like, really, really good.
Oh.
Yeah, that's one of them. One of the fights where it's, like, almost like the sound effects are, like, shrapnel coming out of, like, and they're, like, there's, like, 40 little, like, you know, sound effects kind of thing. And I want to put all that in the show. I just wanted to mention it so I could put it all in the show notes, because it's something that while I was reading, I was really taken with the art. I loved the felt a little bit like Poverty Tourism, if I'm going to be clear. Like, it was just like, look how bad this guy's life is. Aren't you glad you don't live in the slums, kid? But it was beautiful. It was, like, beautifully illustrated. But the sound effects are the one thing that I was like, I think it shows, it's an easy way to show the mastery of this work that you wouldn't necessarily get without reading the whole thing, which I think a lot of people might get intimidated by a hardcover $75, 600-page book when you say read classic manga.
Wait, it's not that expensive, is it?
I believe it is $75.
No.
It's being printed at size, too, like American comic size. It's like it's like an omnibus or something.
$60.
Is it 60? Oh, maybe I was looking at the Canadian price. 60 is way better. That's great. So, yeah, final thought. I think that there's a lot here to dig into, and it's a rich and fascinating work that has problematic elements and also huge successes. And there's a couple things you can do to just show people, hey, this is what Ashino Joe is, and it's kind of awesome. And hopefully that'll twig them to why this is a cool work, why it's important.
So, my final thought. Nice. The gestural sound effects that Christopher was talking about, you can see them on page 62 and also in our show notes. Chip, final thoughts. What do you have?
I liked it.
Love it.
Short and sweet as always, bro.
It was really good. Yeah. I mean, like, I'm not yet an expert in manga, but this feels like the kind of work that everyone needs to read if you're into manga. For $60, you can't go wrong. #sponsored post.
And Deb, what are your final thoughts?
Well, I got the print edition and I whipped through it because I needed to whip through it before I left the country because I didn't want to take it with me. Yeah. You know, like, I think one of the dangers sometimes with older work is sometimes it feels off. The art feels off. Some things feel dated. Culturally, it might feel like, you know, like a little ick. The older manga was created by and for Japanese readers. It was an era when Japanese manga creators never, ever, ever thought that it would be read by anyone else than Japanese people, much less adults, you know, much less girls, you know?
Much less podcasters.
Like, it was shonen manga for boys, right? If you think about it, it's kind of miraculous and wondrous that this manga came out and had such an impact on people. You know, it inspired people. It got people to care about the characters. It got people to kind of put it up there as like an iconic story, type of characters that resonates even 50, 60 years after the fact. Mm-hmm. And that's kind of remarkable because I don't think those creators at the time ever thought it would be more than something disposable entertainment that would be read on a train and left in the trash can at the next stop. Mm-hmm. So, to me, that's just one of the most wonderful things about this book. And it's one of those things that I thought, you know, because it's old, because it's of its time, and historically, U.S. readers have not been receptive to those type of things. But it is so important that we see these things, see these stories as they were, and read them now. Like, it's like we're in the future, right? And we're saying, oh, this influenced so many people. This sounds familiar. This has influenced so many other people, and you have to kind of pause and go, oh, how did it feel when this was the first time this type of character was read? You know, how would that feel? How would I feel if I was in that era, not knowing that there are other stories like it later? It's hard to imagine because, you know, this series is so iconic and so influential, it's hard to shut off your brain that way and enjoy it as it is without knowing all these, its impact. Mm-hmm. But I'm so grateful that it's out there, because I feel you can't appreciate manga without understanding the key works that influence generations of creators. And not just in Japan now, it's influenced generation creators all over, whether they know it or not, whether they know it or not, that it came from this. So I think it's on us as readers of and lovers of this medium to support this type
journalists,
of work.
Sponsored journalists.
So that leads me up to the other one that I want us to read is Legend of Kamui, which came out at about the same time.
Oh, yeah.
And had that same cultural impact on young people. Hmm. And also about income inequality, but albeit a ninja story set in feudal Japan.
Yeah, way more people get killed in that one.
Oh, yeah. Way more. So when you think about it in that way, I should have just kind of a lighthearted little romp in it.
Yeah. Yeah. That was the Shonen Magazine version. Kamui was the alternative magazine version that only university students read. David, we finally come to you. This is the book that we started the podcast. Yeah. You're like, I need Ash to Know Joe. I need Hajime no Ippo. Well, we're here. How are you feeling? What are your final thoughts?
So I bought Ash to Know Joe Volume 1 while it was in Japan on our manga-splaining birth trip. There's got to be a better way to phrase that.
Origin story.
There we go. So I've been looking forward to this for a very long time. And I've got a quote that I'm going to read as my final thought that I really appreciated and kind of sums up the series, serious and in a funny way. Once a boxer's in the ring, he's as alone as a man can be. Let the screaming of your flesh and bone guide you, Joe. Keep fighting till you're spitting blood and can't take another step. Because the outcome of this first fight will determine your destiny. It's a fork in the road to tomorrow. And they say tomorrow so much in this book. Yeah. Constantly.
Oh, they really do.
But it like hits the perfect emotional pitch. It's like, this kid sucks. He's going to get better. You can see him kind of slowly getting better even over these first 600 pages. But he never stops being like a monster fighter, which is really fun. So I'm into it.
And he never gives up on tomorrow, right?
No, he doesn't. He always finds a reason to keep going and be a jerk to someone else.
And that's his prerogative.
Yeah.
Give him a reason to live.
What are you going to do about it, right? Like,
yeah, like I can't fight him. Forget it. So we're going to take a quick break. We're going to run an ad, and then we're going to do shout outs and get out of here. We will see you in a bit.
Kroger, an annual Boost membership just got even better. Now you can choose from Disney Plus with ads, Hulu with ads, or ESPN Plus on us when you sign up. Plus, enjoy unlimited free delivery, double fuel points, exclusive offers, and free items. Sign up for a Boost membership today. It's an easier way to save, including new streaming options to relax with while we deliver your groceries. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Restrictions apply. See site for details. Save big this holiday season, all in the Kroger app. Buy two, get three free on 12 packs of delicious Coca-Cola, Pepsi, or 7-Up. Then get a flavorful Kroger spiral sliced ham for 89 cents a pound with an additional $25 purchase. Limit two, all with your card. Shop these deals at your local Kroger today, or tap the screen now to download the Kroger app to save big today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Prices and product availability subject to change. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
And we are back. We had a nice conversation about Ash to Know Joe, Fighting for Tomorrow. It's definitely should be on your shopping list for this year. It's pretty awesome, I feel. We need shout outs. Chip, what are you shouting out this week?
The past couple of months, I've been reading almost exclusively nonfiction books to prepare for an upcoming project that hasn't been announced. So I can't actually talk about the project or any of the books because it'll give it away. So I'll take my answer off the air. But besides that, I went out and I bought the David Mazzucchelli Batman Year One Artist Edition.
Oh, man. Nice.
Amazing. Amazing.
I was just re-listening to the Daredevil where you guys were talking about the Artist Edition on that. Or not even the Artist Edition, it was just the Black and White Editions.
This is so good. It is designed by Chip Kidd, so it's like it's especially beautiful.
Wow.
And it has one of the best forewords to a piece that gives so much context.
Yes.
Yeah, I highly, highly recommend it to anyone working in comics. It's so beautiful.
Yeah, like a third of the forward is about Daredevil Born Again. So technically, if you're a manga explaining listener, you need this for completion.
Yeah, so much is about like the printing process and color and like, yeah.
It's, yeah.
Wow.
It's a real insight into comics making at the time in the 80s.
Awesome. Yeah. Dev, what do you have to shout out this week?
I'm going to shout out a bar. Bar Lonely in Golden Guy, which is okay. The Ashtana Joe theme bar that I went nice. To with David Hyde back in the day. And I'm realizing I have to drag Christopher and you there someday because it's absolutely amazing. The guy who runs the bar started it when he was 18 in the 1970s. He has an amazing photo album that shows him as a young guy with his guitar. He tells amazing stories about how he dreamed about being a music star in the Showa era of Japan. Huh. He is basically Joe. He's the same age as Joe would have been. And the bar is a tiny little bar that is just filled to the brim with Ashtana Joe memorabilia, movie posters, sketches, anime cells. He knows the director who drew a sketch of him behind the bar with him and Joe.
Oh, wow.
So, and then I found the bar because I walked by it and there was a sketch of Hajinoe Ippo on the cover, on the door. And so I thought, I must look inside. So I didn't know what it was. Wow. And I walked in the bar and it was just Ashtana Joe Land. And it was, I know enough Japanese to have a conversation with the bar owner. And he brought out his photo album. He brought out his guitar and started playing it for us.
He was ready.
He was. And then he showed us some punk rock, American punk rock bands who came by and took photos with him. He's now a guy maybe in his 80s.
Mm-hmm. He started it when he was 18.
18.
That's
wild. What a life.
Yeah, liquor laws weren't a thing. It really was the Great Depression here. Yeah,
much sketchier. So then he started into the 60s, the bar.
Just to be that into an element of pop culture, especially a juvenile element of pop culture, that you're just like, here's the rest of my life based on this. That's wild.
His friends were like, come on, man. It's just a comic book. Yeah.
If you go up to the second floor, it all has horse racing posters. So he's not just an Ashtana Joe guy.
Okay.
But it's fabulous. And Christopher, we must go. We're here on this trip. Down.
You know how
nice.
Comic store owners only started comic book stores so that they had a place to keep all of their comic books? Yeah. Here, when people get really into something, they eventually will open up a bar so they can keep their collection somewhere that's not in their house. And so you get to go to these marvelous theme bars. There's the weirdest one I ever went to was like a dinky car, like a Hot Wheels theme bar in some like small town by the station in Japan. And we were just like, what is going on here? And he's like, this is my collection of Hot Wheels. I opened a bar. It's wild.
Jeez.
Living the dream, man. Living the dream.
Yeah.
Well, so I mean, I know we're going over, but what would your bar be, each of you? Based on Andrew and the thing that you
my
love
husband and
you
I have
collect.
Long conversations about what kind of bar we've opened. I've got a very specific like type of bar, but I would probably do a Japanese like gay manga doujinshi themed bar, but not in Japan. Because it's just like part of every kind of gay bar a little bit here.
Yeah.
So I would probably do it in Taiwan or actually maybe New York. Probably do it. It would be like a little like snack. It'd be like a little 5-seater, 6-seater. So that it would be like hyper exclusive and there'd be gay art everywhere. It would be filthy. It'd be great.
I love it.
Nice. Yeah. Deb, how about you? What's your bar?
I really romanticize Showa era Japan. I want it to be like the time when I first went to Japan in the 1970s when I was a little kid and everything was magical to me. Everything was just, I had never been to such an amazing place where I like all that kitsch, you know?
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
My sister and I went to all the stationery stores and just went nuts. All the movies, like the old Genka Singers, that's the Japanese version of the blues, and then tokusatsu. So yeah, maybe it would be like a 1970s tokusatsu Showa era bar with a Hawaii lens, right? Like we serve poke and spam musubi. Yeah.
Perfect. David, what's yours?
Mine, I think it would be like a jazz bar, but like a drink and draw kind of theme.
Mm. Oh, okay.
You remember we went to a Shinjuku Pit Inn in Japan for my 40th birthday? Christopher, you were there.
Yeah.
I like that a lot, but like the lighting kind of sucks because there's people performing.
Yeah.
So my plan is that bar exactly, but there's pin lights at each table to light your paper while you're working. That's good.
David let me draw on his iPad, actually, so that I could see what I was doing. And I did some gesture drawings, and I hadn't drawn for a little while. It was really nice of him to do that on his birthday to let me use his iPad to draw. Thank you, David.
And I've got some drawings of Spider-Man and people that I can flip on the internet and say I drew myself. It's very beautiful. Perfect. Chip, what's your bar? What would you...
I don't know, just some sex bar.
Makes sense.
Criminals bar, or just sex.
Just sex things. Just come on in. You want sex in the bar? Sure.
Yeah.
I've been to all of your bars, which is what's so hilarious, actually. I've been to the Showa era theme bar and a Hawaiian bar. I've been to the jazz bar that has lights at every table where people are drawing. So it's good. I like that we're all like really on point.
Achievable.
Like, yeah, very achievable bars. Sorry.
I like the Chip's bar. Like, alcohol is a cleanser. You can clean with it, sterilize things. So it's totally safe.
Perfect. Perfect.
Christopher, what's your shout out?
They only offer pure vodka shots so that if it spills, it does half the work. On a completely different emotional note, my pick is Maurice Velikoop, and I think I might have even put it in the show notes already, but he just won the Toronto Book Award, which is never gone to a comic book or a graphic novel before, which is awesome.
Amazing.
Yeah, really, really amazing for his book, I'm So Glad We Had This Time Together, which is his memoir, which he's been working on for like a decade. He's been working on for so, so long. I remember seeing pages forever ago, and it's so good, and it is a chonker of a book, too, so I was glad that they sent me a digital. I don't even know if it's in digital, but Pantheon sent me a digital. And it's so good. I really, really liked it. And it really affected me to the point where I wrote him. And we're friends. Like, Maurice and I, you know, we've known each other for a really long time. I took him to Japan, actually, on one of the TCAP trips. But I wrote him a fan letter, like a full-on, like, I love your book so much. This is what I took this from it. And I don't do that very often. I'm like, I have that steely facade of just working with people, and, you know, being chill about it. But I was so moved by his book, and there was stuff that I took from it and stuff that I was already doing that, and like bits that were like related to our friendship. Like it's awesome. Like it's so, so good. I'm so glad we had this time together. Maurice Velikoop. It is a perfect, weird, quirky, awesome memoir. I've been actually recommending it to people who liked Fun Home, although it's a less traumatic, but more traumatic, deals with substance abuse and things like that a little bit more. Yeah, just fantastic book. So please go check it out.
Amazing. Yeah. My shout out is exactly as emotionally fulfilling as Christopher's. Ages ago, I forget if it was on the show or just in general, Chip recommended The Old Man, which is a series about Jeff Bridges as a former special forces, like kind of spy guy. But he's grown now. His daughter is in trouble. Like there's all kinds of things going on. Anyway, season 2 came out. I watched the first like handful of episodes. I was like, oh man, it's really good. I told Chip it was back. And then the season ended and I was so hooked. I didn't realize it ended for like 2 weeks. I was like, when is the next episode coming out? Like that was a really good cliffhanger. So season 2 of The Old Man definitely grabbed my attention and did not let go. And I can't wait for season 3. Like it's very much like right up my alley so far.
Yeah. My wife and I we've done 3 episodes so far.
Yeah.
We're pacing it out. Yeah. It's really good.
I was opening Hulu. I was like, come on, it came out like Thursdays, right? Like, that's the day for it? I just could not fathom.
That's a sign of a great show where you...
Yeah.
Like, one of the exercises I do in my manga class is I tell the students, look at your Netflix queue and look at the stories that you binged. Look at the series where you faithfully came back on the day the new episode would come out and compare it with the series in your queue that maybe you didn't finish watching the first episode, or maybe 5 or 6 new episodes have come on and you haven't bothered to make the time to watch it.
Mm-hmm.
And compare those two stories. What makes one so compelling that you can't stop watching it, or you just so look forward to it? And what made the other story, as you know, interesting as it may be, just maybe not, you didn't make a priority.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
It always leads to interesting conversations in my class.
I agree. It's a great technique for kind of like picking things apart. And with The Old Man, if you like Third Rock from the Sun, it'll be a very fun show. The gulf between John Lithgow and that, where I first discovered him, and in The Old Man, where he's legitimately scary.
Oh, wow.
Yeah.
John Lithgow is weirdly, weirdly good, eh?
He's really good. Yeah.
Great. Yeah.
I'm a fan. That is our Ashita no Joe Fighting for Tomorrow episode. It is written by Aso Takamori, also known as Iki Kajiwara and Asaki Takamori. He's got a lot of pen names. Drawn by Tetsu Chiba, published by Kodansha. Thank you very much for listening, and we will see you next time.
This has been Manga Explaining, episode 117, featuring Ashita no Joe. Thanks for listening. For our next episode, we'll be discussing the manga Guardians of the Louvre by Jiro Taniguchi. Want to pick up a copy? Consider supporting your local comic book and manga specialty shop. Find one near you at comicshoplocator.com or check out your local library for print and digital lending options. You can also follow along with our complete reading list at mangaexplaining.com. And check out our newsletter and digital publishing endeavor at mangaexplainingextra.com. Thanks to DADS for the musical accompaniment this episode.
Save big this holiday season. All in the Kroger app. Buy two, get three free on 12 packs of delicious Coca-Cola, Pepsi, or 7-Up. Then get a flavorful Kroger spiral sliced ham for 89 cents a pound with an additional $25 purchase. Limit two, all with your card. Shop these deals at your local Kroger today. Or tap the screen now to download the Kroger app to save big today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Prices and product availability subject to change. Restrictions apply. See site for details. At Kroger, an annual Boost membership just got even better. Now you can choose from Disney Plus with ads, Hulu with ads, or ESPN Plus on us when you sign up. Plus, enjoy unlimited free delivery, double fuel points, exclusive offers, and free items. Sign up for a Boost membership today. It's an easier way to save, including new streaming options to relax with while we deliver your groceries. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Restrictions apply. See site for details.